listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
You have nothing to fear from this poet but the truth, Harriet Mullen wrote of poet Douglas Kearney. In Douglas Kearney's poems, you'll find songs, chants, noose knots and booty shakes, a KKK rally, a machete-wielding malcontent. Do these poems reflect politics, absorb politics, deflect politics? We'll hear all about that tonight as Doug reads, performs, sings his poems, and then joins Edgar Arsenault and Daryl Alejandro Holmes in conversation about the political impetus and implications of their work. Douglas Kearney is a poet and performer whose honors include a Whiting Writers Award, a Coat Hanger Award, and the Penn Center USA nomination. He's performed nationwide, including at the Public Theater, the Orpheum, and the World Stage. We have some folks from the World Stage here tonight. I want to welcome them. He's earned an MFA from CalArts, yes, World Stage, and teaches there now. His most recent collection of poetry is The Black Automaton, and his other books include Fear Some, which was published by Red Hand Press. Performances of Douglas Kearney's libretti have been featured in Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, and Europe. He's a native of Brooklyn, New York, where my grandmother lived, and he is both an alumnus of, and he now teaches at CalArts. And we'll be selling books by both Douglas and Edgar afterwards, and they'll be signing their books in the lobby. Edgar Arsenault, I'm going to introduce everyone right now, and then we'll be hearing from them one by one. Edgar Arsenault is another CalArts alumnus and a native of Los Angeles. His artist practice takes advantage of his truly restless intellectual investigations, which are wonderful. His mix of multidisciplinary skills include drawing, photography, sculpture, and filmmaking. He's the recipient of many awards, including the U.S. Artists Awards, and his many solo shows include exhibitions at the Hammer, the Kitchen, the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, Suzanne Vielmetter Los Angeles Projects, and the Studio Museum of Harlem. His work has also been included in the Whitney Biennial and the California Biennial. Arsenault's studio work often examines memory and place, and lately he's turned his focus to Detroit, a site of social unrest and economic decline, looking at the risk of the present becoming a ruin. We'll also hear about Edgar's involvement, his long involvement, with the Watts House Project, where he's been director since 1999. The Watts House Project brings residents together in a creative partnership with artists, architects, design professionals, and volunteers to revitalize the neighborhood and reimagine the environment through inventive programming, community involvement, and functional and creative housing renovations. My staff and I visited WHP earlier this month on a rainy day, and it was just so memorable and so moving to see these very intimate interventions in the housing on the street and their interactions with the people who live there. It's really the personal as political. And Daryl Alejandro Holmes is the poetry director, programs director of the Poetry Society of America. He's an award-winning poet and playwright originally from Panama City, Panama. He holds degrees in creative writing from the University of Michigan and the University of Houston, and his poetry has appeared in many journals. And his play, The Burning Room, was a winner of the WSU National Student Playwriting Award. We welcome Daryl to Los Angeles from New York. We're going to start tonight with Douglas Kearney, so please welcome Douglas to the stage. Please welcome our entire panel. Take it away.
Good evening. Thank you all. I'm going to start tonight with a brief statement about my poetics and their connection to politics. During the course of my presentation, I'll also probably launch into at least one poem. But I promise the presentation is full of all the kind of ridiculousness that I like to put into my poetry anyway. So the reason my presentation is called Shuffle, Stagger, Shimmy. I want to discuss the politics in my poetics through a set of personally emergent categories. These classifications suggest strategies and because of their associations with performance and performance ranging from everything from sort of minstrel shows to the burlesque, they also speak to my content around performativity. What draws me to this to these terms as a way of articulating the politics in my poetics is they each speak to a kind of robust contradiction. And I'm going to get into that. Consider syncretism in voodoo, the slang inversion of bad into good, hyper-present baggy jeans as stash spots for contraband, the contested interpretation of spirituals as codes for escape routes, the quilts as message boards. Each of these speak to a kind of hiding in plain sight. This contradiction is a critical part of African-American aesthetic practices, and it's something that engages me as well. My question about this is, how can the work of writers like Fred Moten and Harriet Mullen, who practice what might be called, in Moten's case, fugitive poetics, and Harriet Mullen, the runaway tongue, both are slant-rooted in a kind of an African diasporic aesthetic, and as Moten points out, the wanted fugitive is wanted precisely because he's unwanted. So you see the kinds of contradictions within that. How can their work function as a kind of guiding principle to push my work beyond the context of poetry? And I want to say that art offers a kind of cognitive technology through which we can learn to think our way through problems with analogs outside the gallery, the book, or the theater. Thinking our way through doesn't necessarily mean we've solved the problem. Consider like the blues singer who might go on about how I lost my woman, she left me there in the cold. And by the time we get to the last verse, the blues singer is working through that problem, not necessarily resolving it. He doesn't necessarily get the woman back. He doesn't necessarily realize that she was wrong for leaving him because she was actually the guilty party. He just moves on. So instead of a kind of figuring out a solution, there's just the opportunity to transcend. So I think that art can provide us with that. Reckoning with something gives us the opportunity to actually come to a reckoning. I'm interested primarily in how to hold the contradictions that we talked about earlier, I'm saying we, like y'all are speaking, but it's me. Mine, I have the microphone. Anyway, all right, so let's move first to shuffle. All right. The shuffle is an effort to please, an obsequious recalibration and recapitulation in which the shuffler remains off balance. Yeah, y'all didn't know I was going to do the whole minstrel thing. All right. But this shuffle has been adapted to the footwork of boxers also, like Muhammad Ali. Shuffle, shuffle, bust 'em, right? The shuffler questions the foundation of the exchange upon which the two are meeting. What is the grounds? The shuffler remains off balance. And we could think about this as a submissive position. But if we think about it in the realm of Ali, it is actually a powerful position. Because typically, the shuffler's off balance because the foundation is not what serves the shuffler in the first place. Consider the shuffler who says, after he does something wrong, I'm sorry, boss, you wouldn't have to hurt little old me, would you? You wouldn't have to. The foundation says he should, but the shuffler switches that foundation right after the transgression. In my work, shuffle becomes a shifting of units of language, like here with the word crack, and also the word buck, and also the word white kill. To Big Thicket, a crack is a buckshot. To Big Thicket, crack is a stick broke crack. Headlights staggering the home, the road kills, buck crack. To Big Thicket, we go, two sticks, two stick bucks, hot drink, drink heads, light stagger, in the load, long the trees, long the creek, crack, stick broke, light kills, we go, two Big Thicket, to home on a kill, buckshot, crack, stagger by drink, headlight to Buck Thicket, buck on each pickup, staggering, what you looking at? The pickup, headlights, long the road, crack, buck broke, crack, the white stick, Big Thicket, long the trees, long the creek, drink, stagger, broke, white, kill the buck, staggering home, crack, the trees, pick up, we go, to Big Thicket, what you doing here? Buck, stick to home, crack, stick broke, huff, huff, go, white light, break the trees, break for home, long the road home, white's homing on, we, huff, huff, go, buckshot, crack, 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 crack. So that's a kind of a shuffling, right? And a part of the movement of that language asks the question, maybe this works here, or maybe here. Is this better here? Keeping the reader off balance as to how to appropriately respond to the work. I would hope that this performs a process of critical questioning of the message, how something that sounds right may not, in the language of the roots, not feel right. This is a poem called Is Ain't, another sort of usage of this kind of shuffling technique. and it's about blackface. This is a poem called Radio, in which radio, the word radio is shuffled from meaning blood to love to back to blood, back to blacks, shuffling. This is Flood Song 7, Catfish's Bounce, which remixes a bit of Langston Hughes' The Negro Speaks of Rivers. This is a section from Quantum Spit, a larger hip-hop poem. This is a new poem, A Jungle Fever, King Kong. Again, you'll see the shuffling of right in the center. If you like them big, you like them big? Like big? Big. Big? A lady don't like it big if she raised right on the empire. Go the filthy black hand up that great white ray where dreams are made of. Stagger. I'm going to move quickly because I don't want to cut into the presentation and the conversation time because that's what y'all are here for. The stagger belongs to beings who are not fully present in their bodies. Drunk stagger, the critically wounded stagger, bad dancers stagger, zombie stagger. But people playing at any of these states stagger broadly. Slapstick and pratfalls lingua franca is the stagger. We can think of different dance steps, however. When that staggering is actually performed, it actually becomes a reflection of actual grace. So as opposed to being somebody who is not fully a master of their body, grace is someone who is a master of their body. So think of any number of dance steps, from the jerk, to the Roger Rabbit, to the camel walk, to hoofing, to Motown footwork, to the up rock, to capoeira. The physicality of these staggers interests me. And through performative typography, I've sought out ways to stagger the poem from its body as a means of calling its attention to the body and the act of reading. Just very quickly, this is a poem from the second book, The Black Automaton in Tag, Negro. Somewhere along the way, I felt that those poems were too neat, and so I started making poems that looked a little bit more like that. That's Well Hung from a new chapbook called Skin Mag. That's Drop It Like It's Hot and Tot Venus. That's Negro. This is The Black Automaton and What It Is, number 2, Hypertension and a Physect. This is The Black Automaton and What It Is, number 3, Work It Out, kind of a club song about the Rwandan genocide, with samples from Destiny's Child, the 69 Boys, who had a song called Tootsie Roll. And as you know, the Hutu were murdering the Tutsi. And so there's a verse from that, a little line that goes, "Let me see that Tootsie Roll." And so that gets sampled here, Tootsie Roll being a candy also. And work goes through a number of different definitions in sort of hip hop vocabulary, everything from murdering to drugs. So we have that. And this is No Homo, which is actually dedicated to two writers, one of whom I see right here. This is a kind of response to Lil Wayne's claim of No Homo, which is just a kind of a protection of his masculinity. Finally, I think that protection of masculinity is a perfect transition into The Shimmy. The Shimmy is about desire. While one might interpret The Shimmy as an offering up, you know, that kind of sexy sort of, it's kind of an offering up, right? But it also is a lure, right? The Shimmy puts something out, and it's like the hokey pokey. It offers it, but then it's not there. It offers it, and it's not there. It's an absent presence, and it's a lure to bring somebody to you. So it's not an offering up in any way different than a fishing line is an offering up. The person offering it actually wants something, has an agency, has a goal. And that's another space where I see a kind of a contradiction that is a fascinating thing to work on. And to me, The Shimmy is about desire, not seduction, but desire, which I think is management of desire is an incredibly political concept. It is part of the major work of politics, managing the desire of who you're addressing, right? This has been a harder sort of thing for me early on. This is a page from my some pages from my libretto that was my thesis project at CalArts. On the left is an artificial language, an invented language. That would be the English part of it. On the right would, throughout the opera, be blocked. The translations would be blocked by different things on the stage, frustrating the desire of the viewer to get and apprehend the text, right? So that would happen throughout it. So that was a kind of shimmy. Here's another one, and another one. This is a poem called Swim Chant for Nigger Merfolk. It's a peppy poem about the Middle Passage. Here, shimmy is a kind of a change, like a volta. What you wanted is not what you end up getting from this poem. Canal Rats Chanty, also a kind of blurring. This is from Thank You, But Please Don't Buy My Children Clothing with Monkeys on Them. One section of that, little monkeys. Little monkeys, curly-cued tails, troop queries on my babies, curious. Little monkeys and the uniformed overseer, who can tame them? Unruly little monkeys, no ways tired with new IDs and bipedal reveries. Musing little monkeys is pointless. Stick them with sticks, big leaps from their green tenements. Angry little monkeys, go chew on the saw, fruit falls when ripe. Wait, hungry little monkeys, smiling little monkeys, climbing pajamas. Little monkeys, pincer the cribs, bent scissors, my daughter's onesie. Leering little monkeys. Pincer the cribs, bent senators, hissing in little monkey beards. Little monkeys' hands all murder soft. Put your hands up, little monkeys. Shot, love for little monkeys. Little monkeys, humans over little monkeys, motherfucker. Little monkeys over babies, bucking on the lamps, messing the light, smearing little monkey shadows on my son's face. Little monkeys gibber from the nursery, porch, the street. Little monkeys, aha, freeze, little monkeys. Foul my baby's clothes like blood, like shit. Little monkeys, thank you, no. Little monkeys, no, thanks, no. Thanks.
I was so sure. Nice. Thank you.
You know, a little behind the curtain politics, you know, I had set up my whole presentation with me going first because I really did not want to follow Doug because of how fantastic he was. You know, because part of my introduction is that I had a little joke that was going to say something along the lines of, well, if we're not entertaining, at least, you know, we won't be too hard on the eyes because, you know, my two friends here are quite handsome. And at least it'll be something to look at. Huh, not as handsome? Yes, thank you very much. So my presentation is in here somewhere. Rick? Huh? Minimize. And then? Maximize, thank you. This is going to be, you see when you started, this is going to be a very interactive presentation. Okay, so hi everybody, I'm Edgar Arsenault. I'm an artist. I'm from Los Angeles, and you know, I just had to confess, you know, I'm a little bit nervous giving this talk, not because I haven't given it 1,000 times, but because my wife is here and she never comes to my presentations, but she's here today. So if I stagger, stutter, fall, or trip, you can all blame it on her. So Louise was kind enough to have us all here together and to ask me and Doug and Daryl to present 15 years of work in 10 minutes. So what I thought that I would do is to present what I consider to be three kind of cornerstone projects in my practice over the last 16 years. One of them being the Triadic Drawing Series, which I started back in 1996. Which is a series of works that are based on coincidence and chance, or what you can call poetic redundancies that happen over time. And the very first one is the one that you're seeing here, which is called Spock, Tuvok, Tupac. And I was inspired to make this drawing because I was watching Star Trek, The New Generation, which my father was a Trekkie and introduced me to the series. But when I saw this new Vulcan, Tuvok, this African-American Vulcan, I was really interested in him because I knew that Spock was representative of the Jewish intellectual kind of projected into outer space. So I thought to myself, well, what does this mean exactly to have a black Vulcan? Because usually within the media scape, African-Americans are presented as sensates, ones which sort of manage through the world, through their emotions, as opposed to using their intellect. But Spock always embraced a kind of paradox, you know, this trying to struggle between his humanity and his Vulcan kind of intellectualism. But every time I said the word Spock Tuvok, then the word Tupac Shakur would pop into my head. And for 3 weeks, I tried to shake it until I realized what was happening was that the inclusion of Tupac was creating a system of relationships between these two figures, which one could not easily resolve. Over time, I turned this into a methodology of working in which I had a number of drawings, and this one sort of gives you a sense of the scale. of drawings that were based on coincidence and chance, poetic things that would happen. So if I'm walking down the street and somebody says Tiger Woods, for example, in this drawing, he had just won the Masters. This one is called Two Woods in a Forest. That's a drawing of a forest, a drawing of a woods, and Tiger Woods. This one is called 1968, which was based on an article I read in Vibe magazine, where Uhura, who is the African-American communication officer on the show, was retelling a story about how she went to a Martin Luther King speech and how he recognized her. And afterwards, they struck up a conversation, and he actually convinced her to stay on the show. Now, number one, I had no idea that Martin Luther King was watching Star Trek. And number two, I just had no idea that Martin Luther King watched Star Trek. You know, it's still sort of, that's still surprising to me. Also in 1968 was the first episode that they did in the original series where they would travel back in time, which would be our present, and, you know, Spock would put on a beanie and hide his pointy ears, and they would navigate through some sort of story to some sort of resolve. And that was also the same year that the King family was in 1968, also was the assassination. But at the time when I made this drawing in 1997 was when the King family estate was trying to reopen the case, in essence, to retell the story of the assassination of King as not one lone gunman. So as you can see up there in the corner, I have them now pointing at the USS Enterprise as opposed to the direction where James Earl Ray supposedly had fired that bullet. As I was making those drawings, what happened is that the system of working, which was me trying not to consciously make the connections between the images, but to let them happen through time, the system itself became self-conscious. I started having dreams of connections, and it was at that point that I realized that I needed to stop. But one of the reactions that I was having to the work, which was both positive and also I thought was sort of an endpoint, was that people were really attracted to the manual dexterity, the fact that the drawings were made very well. But I wanted the work to be able to exist within a much larger constellation of ideas in which they can both be emotionally attractive but also intellectually be pointing towards something greater. And I took a trip with my father and my mother, who just walked in. Hi, Mommy. To Houston. They came and visited me in Houston, and we went to visit my father's hometown of Beaumont and Galveston, Texas. And for him, it was this attempt to re-experience the past, because he hadn't been back there for 40 years. But for me, it was about the inability to do so. Because not only had the streets changed and the neighborhood had changed, the geography had changed, but his memories of the place had also altered and changed. So what I did within this installation, which I've been working on since 1999, I guess I do have some commitment issues when it comes to art. You know, I just keeps on going. I started to project my father's memories of the place onto the landscape. So it's this ongoing process of drawing, changing, and rearranging. And I'm about to remake this piece in Sydney at the Museum of Contemporary Art in March. One of the instances that really triggered the idea was me visiting the home that my father grew up in. And then when we turned the corner to find the home, all that remained was a grassy field and a tree stump. And for him, you know, he sort of showed no emotion at all, which really kind of struck me. I don't know if you remember this, Mom. But when we went to visit the cemetery later on, which this is a drawing of, we went to look for his grandmother's grave. Which is really sort of the kind of the central point of the happiness of his childhood. But the only thing that he could remember to locate the grave was during the funeral that there were cars passing by near the along the road. But when we tried to locate the grave, we were never able to find it. But what was sort of magical about the cemetery was that there were these seemed to be 200-year-old trees that were toppling over the tombstones. The grass was overgrowing in every direction. It had just rained, it was hot, it was summery, birds chirping, the mosquitoes were eating us alive. But I thought later, wouldn't it be this amazing sort of metaphor to imagine the roots of these age-old trees stretching themselves out and wrapping themselves around all the bodies in the cemetery, creating this underground system of relations, which was completely invisible to us. This connection between home and history and family and the malleability of space and the politics that are associated with them is part of the interests that have drawn me to Watts House Project. I've been involved with Watts House since 1996. We describe it as an artist-driven neighborhood redevelopment organization. We're based in Watts. right across the street from the historic Watts Towers. Artists and architects and families work together to bring about improvements to their homes. And renovations are sort of at the heart of what we do. But we also have programming, which is meant to be not just a transformation of the home, but also to work with the family to leverage their skill sets towards the improvement of the neighborhood and ideally grow their businesses at the same time. Improving the homes, growing the infrastructure of the family. And ultimately, what we're trying to do is not to turn everybody into an artist, but to simply change the roles that people play in the reshaping of their public space. Conocimiento is a term that I learned recently, but this is really at the heart of what we try to do, which is to build a space of for building rapport amongst strangers, where strangers can become friends, building trusting relationships, which can then lead to co-powerment or shared kind of building activity. This is where we're located in the pink area right now. That's our five projects in our redevelopment zone. These five projects are kind of our demonstration projects. One of them I'm going to show you, which is very special to us. We just got a grant from Art Place for $370,000 to renovate these three properties. And by LA standards, they're pretty old. They're about 100 years old. They're actually built by hand by the Burnett family that migrated here from somewhere in the South. One of the things that we try to do is to partner with folks in which we can find mutual benefit. And in this case, it was the School of Architecture at USC. Some of our partners are like the Hammer Museum or LACMA. We've worked with Art Center College of Design or students from Biola University or the local church that's been there for 88 years. The idea that they had was to create a kind of a facade improvement that would be high impact with low cost, because in reality, we actually had the ugliest houses on the block. So working with folks within the neighborhood and the school, we were able to create this level of transformation. But what we're intending to do now is to transform most of these houses, pretty much all of them, back into livable residential homes. And the reason why we decided to do that is because there were a few folks on the block who were looking, who were in the crosshairs of being forcefully evicted from their home. And my thought was, how can we call ourselves Watts House Project if we didn't allow for that basic security of house and home? So we completely changed our programming for that space. So the leveraging of local skill sets, and this is two good examples. This is Rosario Alvarez, who's our resident chef who loves to cook. She learned it from her mother, but has no ability to be able to start her own business. So we're working with her in an incubation capacity to be able to start a catering business. So she cooks all of the meals, she caters all of our tours and events, and everybody loves her food. And by the way, if you guys ever come and visit us, let me know far enough in advance, and I'll make sure Rosario hooks up something for you. But her husband, Hinaro, is our resident blacksmith. He started welding his first project when he worked with us, but he didn't have a license. So one of our programs is we created a vocational scholarship program, where now I'm proud to say he's one exam away from getting his license. So we see ourselves as an innovative model that merges art and architecture and community building. But at the heart of what all these things sort of are drawn together, and Daryl asked me to show this one slide, and then I think we're going to cut into our conversation, is that for folks like me and like Doug, and I imagine for many of you who are driven by your passions towards either a mission, a purpose, or an intent, oftentimes that's an extension of our values, you know, an extension of our own personal temperament. But when we start to organize ourselves, the financial architecture of that thing oftentimes becomes overbearing, where the passion and the joy gets ruined by having to constantly raise money. So within our practices, how are we able to strike a balance between the things that we value with our own temperament and be able to build relationships in the same way we do with the community, with the spokes of support that we need to be able to realize these things, so that it's also joyful for us as well as bringing benefit to others. So that's my presentation. Thank you.
Hello. Let's have another round of applause for Doug and Edgar.
How did I do on the time?
Oh, I thought you were fine. So I'm Daryl Alejandro Holness with the Poetry Society of America. Are you guys ready for a conversation? Great. So Doug and Edgar, let's explore art as a means to exercise politic. How does your art practice create a dialogue? Is that dialogue political?
You know, I oftentimes do have the opportunity to talk to folks after a reading, you know, and the conversations range from everything. Why did you use that word? As I said, I have a poem called Swim Champ for Nigger Merfolk. And so, you know, a wide range of people come up to me and ask me, why would I use that word? And I say, because it's the exact word that needed to be used, not G-G-A, not G, not N-I-G-R-A, but that word speaks to a very specific kind of abjection and a kind of disregard that the poem required. I mean, to me, the work of a poem is not coming up with an idea, it's finding the right words and the right syntax with which to make that idea mean something to someone beyond, besides you, and also to unlock what you actually think about that idea. So I've had conversations about that, but I've also had conversations about, in the same poem, people said, I don't know how to react to a poem about the Middle Passage that has a line from Disney's Little Mermaid in it. I don't know how I'm supposed to react to that.
But they're totally related.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they are related. I mean, because the Middle Passage does have mythological qualities to it. I mean, it's archetypal in its very essence. I mean, there's a group that's called Underground Resistance that's out of Detroit.
Right.
And one facet of the group is called Drexia. And the Drexian mythology is reminiscent of Parliament's mythology about outer space. But their whole thing is about looking at inner space, sort of like not the darkness of that which is outside, but the darkness which is within us. Mm-hmm. So they came up with this story, which is what during the Middle Passage, when pregnant women would get sick, so oftentimes they would be thrown overboard. Mm-hmm. But their story was, well, since the babies were already breathing in liquid anyway, wouldn't it be amazing if they were born in water and then they swam themselves to the shores of Detroit and they live amongst us. Mm-hmm. And guess what? You know, the aliens are you, is sort of the idea. Mm-hmm. But that mythological quality that you're talking about, I mean, Disney is actually very good. And now that I actually know a couple Disneys, you know, I have to be careful how critical I am of them. But, you know, the Disney is actually very good at taking very difficult and complicated mythological subject matters and then turning them into caricatures. Like, what was what's the cartoon they did about the son of Zeus?
Hercules.
Hercules, because Hercules' mother was raped by Zeus. Yeah. You know, he came as a goose, and, you know, then the baby was born, and he's a bastard. But in Disney, you know,
he's a hero.
Yeah.
From zero to hero in no time flat, actually, is how the song puts it.
Hercules.
Right. Yeah, exactly. The God, it was some of the first actual humanoid black people in a Disney cartoon were the Greek muses in Hercules.
So that was the first time?
It was one of the first times that you had
you had the Song of the South, though.
Yeah, but those were all animals, you know, all the animated figures.
Well, the animated, there was a real black man.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the cartoons.
Oh.
They didn't, when they had their kind of, and you know, I went to CalArts, so in Disney I trust, but, but you know.
So did I. I went to
CalArts. But you know, when they had their kind of the renaissance in the early 90s, late 80s of Disney, that started with The Little Mermaid, right? And then they went to Beauty and the Beast, and they went to Aladdin.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing, you know, ethnic treatments of people.
Right, and then Mulan.
Pocahontas, and when they got to Africa, it was back to animals.
Yeah.
It was The Lion King. So the first, human characters, I say humanoid because they're goddesses, but you know, that's still a plus. So, you know, you begin to see that there. And I mean, the project of transforming these sort of folktales, oftentimes, folktales, fairy tales, miracle stories that are the backbone of Disney's film production does have that kind of cleaning up and simplifying that some, like the folklorist Jack Zipes connects to Charles Perrault, who took things like, you know, Little Red Riding Hood, which initially was a a story that involved a girl saving herself, outsmarting a wolf. And when Charles Perrault got his hands on it, he turned into the hunter, saves her because the stupid girl disobeys the mother and gets eaten, raped by a wolf.
Moral, becomes now, a moral tale.
What I'm hearing is that your politic is inscribed in a kind of exploration of mythology, which is obviously articulated in your rhetoric as a poet. Would you say that you also explore mythology in your work, Edgar, or how do you see your politics?
Yeah, I mean, most definitely. But I think a good segue is to talk about the things that you don't see in the Disney cartoons, like you were saying. Yeah. I mean, my buddy Kurt Foreman, who is a sort of an authority on sci-fi and horror films, he's like, one of his lines that always stuck with me was, you know, Edgar, you know, the politics are in the background. Mm. So it's not of what they're showing you centrally within the foreground, but oftentimes it's the stuff that you're not seeing that really is sort of ultimately an expression of his politic.
Right.
Within my work, I don't think of myself as being an overtly political artist because I'm not. Nor do I even really imagine myself as an activist, though people have associated that with me because of the work in Watts House.
Mm-hmm.
But where I think that the politic comes from ultimately is within the methodologies that we use to construct the narratives that we tell. So a good example of that is with the Spock Tuvok Tupac work. Like that whole body was described by indeterminacy and chance. So each one of the juxtapositions was really a matter of a system, not a matter of my own taste.
Right.
But clearly, the things that resonated with me is an aspect of myself.
Right.
That does come out. So the things that we juxtapose ultimately becomes an expression of his politic, but it's not an overt political expression. So, you know, with, you had a question?
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say with another project that I did that was called Rootlessness, and which is a funny story because I was watching what I thought was an episode of Star Trek one Sunday afternoon when I was flipping through the channels, but turned out to be an episode. Do you know this one? But it turned out to be an episode of Roots. Which I was saying to myself, like,
Toby Klingon.
Yes, exactly. Because, like, you remember, Sasha, you must remember this. Like, I was like, why are all these Star Trek actors in Roots, and why is Roots doing a Christmas special? Because it turns out that there's three generations of Roots.
There are.
So they did a reprisal of Roots, and I actually believe that LeVar Burton was playing Geordi LaForge in Star Trek at the time when he took on his role as Kunta Kinte again. And of course, he's much heavier now. I mean, he was on a diet, but you could see he was much fatter, and it was just really a bad. He still had his visor on.
Yeah. He was like wearing it on the set, the wrong set.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. He's like, where am I?
But I see you behind that tree. I mean, you know.
But the thing that was really interesting to me is that I was thinking to myself, like, what a peculiar kind of genealogy that that Sisko from Deep Space Nine and the captain from that LeVar Burton and that Tuvok would be in it. And then also Captain Janeway was in it.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, like, is this, like, maybe these guys have come together in other films. So I had come up with this whole theory, and I had told my dealer I was going to make a show about this, and that I was going to track all of the films. My art dealer, thank you. Yeah, I told my art dealer.
Because, you know,
I was wondering.
Thank
you, thank you. My art dealer, yes. That's what I had intended to say. I told my art dealer I was going to make a show based upon finding the genealogy of all the actors that were in Roots and in Star Trek. And, of course, there was going to be this amazing cosmology of films, and I was going to make drawings based on these films. But to my dismay, these were pretty much the only two films that these guys had ever been in together. It was in Roots and then in Star Trek. But when I took a step back after I was totally frustrated and completely demoralized by proposing a project that I thought that I knew how it was going to turn out and it didn't, what I realized by stepping back from it is that though the actors had never gone on to play in films with each other, a pattern did emerge. And the pattern was that a lot of the male actors went on to play either father figures or priests or religious kind of figures. Or that a lot of the men went on to play sons of priests or ministers or pastors. And then there was Captain Janeway, who was the mother of them all. So this connection to roots, which is really about tracing bloodlines
right.
in a very deterministic model, which at the time when it was written by Haley was connected to a certain notion of black identity, which had a great degree of agency. But within the 2000s, those ideas had really become out of date. So I discovered a pattern which was not based on genealogy, but mm-hmm. one which was based on a different kind of order.
Right.
And in choosing those two subjects and then expressing this other order of connection, that ultimately became the expression of the politic. But again, that was a matter of the system.
So finding a different order, we're reconfiguring social narratives here. Mm-hmm. And these dialogues in art are typically bifurcated between the formal and the conceptual. But I feel as though both of you work towards connection, that it's really more than just an exploration of the formal conceits that you have in the theories or the conceptual, but there's an important community component there. Can you talk about how your work really transcends that?
Well, I mean, something I said in my presentation is this idea of art as providing a kind of cognitive technology. Mm-hmm. And I first started coming to that when I was looking at poetic forms. And I was in Mexico City a couple of weeks ago, and we had a Q&A, and somebody asked a question about the sonnet as a love poem. And I said, well, it's sure, the sonnet works as a love poem, but as a device, the sonnet is about advancing an argument and then turning that argument
right.
in the last moment. Either in Petrarchan, you have the volta after the octave, the first eight lines, or in the Elizabethan, you have that final couplet that reverses the course of everything. So in a way, it's about arguing with oneself or a kind of contradiction. Mm-hmm. Haiku captures the moment right before an epiphany takes place. It arranges all the furniture necessary to have an epiphany, but it doesn't contain the epiphany. Mm-hmm. And its brevity is about the kind of quicksilver of thought. That's why typically haiku doesn't use metaphor or simile, because that's the business of kind of like the reverie following it. This is seeing the world as it is and about to come to something. And I think that form can do certain things. There's a reason why one might use a sonnet, one might use a ghazal, one might use a sestina.
Right.
That they're, you know, completely different. And so for me, that's an important consideration, because it creates in the reader who is familiar with the tropes of that form an expectation. And I love expectation, because you cannot surprise without expectation. Mm-hmm. Right. You can't change without a same. Mm. You can't deviate without a status quo. So I like to work with that idea. I do think that there is a political thrust to that, because these concepts change, you know, as with Obama, you know, status quo. These all are transdisciplinary concepts. What are we seeing on this page versus what are we seeing in the street? What are we seeing in music? And so for me, the content and the form, that to me is the most interesting part of the puzzle. How to speak this, how to get at. And I mean, like the weird typography stuff started off for me in some ways because I was being lazy. Like I didn't want to explain. There's a poem I have called Atomic Buck Dance. And I didn't want to explain that I saw a connection between the figure of the singer in African-American culture, and the figure of the victim in African-American culture, and the figure of the authority as being connected to the victim. I didn't want to write a poem that, in even beautiful language, said, and you know the singer sings the song of pain. I didn't want to, I was like, no, hell no, I don't want to do that shit. So I was like, what if I make it a part of the formal structure of the poem in
right.
that the typeface for the singer is italicized, the typeface for the authority is in all caps. Mm. The typeface for the victim is in all caps, italics. Mm. So it takes on the family characteristics, the genealogy of these two other classes. Now, if somebody doesn't recognize, they don't sit down in the poem and go like, oh, well, I see the connection. But to me, it's there. Like, I don't necessarily, it's what you were saying about the politics being the back. I don't have to know how an engine works to know when I'm in a car with a really good engine versus another one. Your experience of the poem is built out of the decisions that I made and your own personal subjectivity. So whether or not you know that or not is not necessarily the point, but it informed my decisions, which were instrumental in making the poem that you're looking at.
So I hear a lot about intersectionality here, mm-hmm, and I know that both of your works, explore the intersectionality of race, class, gender, mm-hmm. and genre.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there is a certain negotiation of expectation there. Do you think that this intersectionality creates a kind of double consciousness? You were talking about Obama earlier. Where are we with that?
What's the question again? I'm sorry. I was still thinking about what he said.
I am profound.
I'm going to comment on that. You are.
Oh, I try.
You said profound?
Yes. That's
yeah, okay. So, yeah,
make I, sure I got
yeah. You got it right.
Profound.
Yes, you got it.
Okay. So both of you guys are incredibly profound.
That's it.
In the way that race, class, gender, and genre intersect in your work. Mm-hmm. Do you think that creates a kind of double consciousness? Edgar, I know that you have a lot of ideas about the juxtaposition of all these different concepts in your work.
Can I jump on the in talking about your work? Because
go ahead, yeah.
Because I like the notion of the double consciousness, but I also like the idea that, okay, so double consciousness, African over here, American over here, right? But we came to a certain point where there is a third consciousness, which is African American, mm. right? There is the porous quality of this middle ground. The mediator becomes that. So to me, looking at Tupac Spock, Tupac occupies the space of a mediator. There are three consciousnesses, that are happening. You know, forest, two woods, and a forest. Like these kinds of things, it's easy to sort of bifurcate it, right? But when you add that third consciousness, this new reckoning, like, you know, when Du Bois comes up with double consciousness, that, you know, it was a new idea.
Right.
But we had, you know, 100 plus years to kind of work on that, right? And so now the opera that I pulled out, the libretto for the opera, was about a third space, a third consciousness in there. So I think that the work sets up these potential consciousnesses, but then the work in and of itself acts as a kind of interlocutor between them. It puts them in the same room and insists they talk.
Do you agree?
I think.
No, I do agree with, actually, surprisingly, I agree with everything that Doug has said so far. But my interests are not in interrogating the notions of race. My interests are in the vehicles and the stories that we use to interrogate those subjects. So you could say that it's more epistemologically based. It's not necessarily what we know, but what are the tools, what are the vehicles by which we come to know them.
Right.
And I think that what you were expressing earlier about, you know, a sonnet versus a haiku is about understanding that method is in itself content.
Right, right.
The, not just the stories that we tell, but the vehicles that we use to tell them are essentially important. As, you know, both of us know, having children, that there's lots of different ways that you could say something to your kid right. when they've done something wrong. You know, you can scream it out at them, and the whole vehicle completely decimates it and just leaves an overall sentiment of fear or, you know, sadness.
Authority.
Yeah. They dislike that. Yes, yeah. Exactly. One story that I like to tell is that there's a, you know, Muybridge. You guys, everybody know who Muybridge is? So, you know, Muybridge did these kind of scientific studies of movement through still photography. You know who Muybridge is, Michael? Mm-hmm. Michael is my banker friend. So if Michael knows who somebody is, then everybody should know who somebody is. I'm only messing with him because we went to the same elementary school. So two different time frames, though. But you know who Muybridge is, Michael? Okay, that's a good way to put it. But he used a scientific method to understand movement. So this is before cinema. So he would shoot series of photographs, and then you could actually study the way in which things move. But later on, yes, just like that, ma'am. Just like that. There you go. Does everybody see her? What is your name? Thank you, Carrie. She's helping me out today. It's a very long strip. The That's right. One. So this was a predecessor to film. But he didn't have the idea of film. So what he did, because he knew he wanted to project it within motion, he put the photographs upon a glass wheel, a cylinder in which he would spin. Now, because he was using a glass plate that he would spin and then the light would go through. Because he was using a kind of a closed loop system, what that did is that it predetermined the stuff in which he was actually able to represent. Because you can do a horse galloping because more or less that's sort of a repetitive action. Right. But if you're doing something which is more organic or something which is grounded in nature, like wind or clouds blowing, these things never come back to themselves again. Right. So his tools actually limited the things that he could represent. Right. And what he represented actually predetermined the use of his tools. Exactly. For me, you know, as I'm thinking about double consciousness, I mean, my interest is in it as a subject because mm-hmm. I myself, you know, have felt some of those notions. But at the same time, I'm also interested in what understandings are derived through the meeting of these two things, and the way in which they don't work with each other, and how there's a certain space of power and that kind of what you call the shuffle or the dance where the person trips, that's kind of the drunken master style.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the sort of the in-betweenness. And that's why Bruce Lee was so badass, because he was like, I have no style. Right. So when he was fighting Kareem Abdul-Jabbar at the end of the
Game of Death,
thank you. You know, the reason why Kareem was so powerful was because he didn't fit within any category. Right. And I think as artists, what's sort of particularly important for us as cultural producers is that we're constantly trying to figure out a way of mining the spaces which other people have not done so well or have not attempted to do. Right, right. So these understandings are always, in a way, of the world, mm-hmm. but what we do is not of the world. It's in itself its own world. It points back to the politics that are going on in Iraq or Afghanistan, but when it's in your photograph, in your work, in your gallery, your studio, it is not Afghanistan. It is your interpretation of the work in your studio and your gallery between you and your audience and your dealer. I mean, your drug dealer at this point.
So that feeds into my next question, which is we've talked about the vehicle of form and we've talked about the vehicle of materials and method. To what extent do you feel that your vehicle really remarks on your national heritage or your sense of community in that larger sense?
Jesus. That's a tricky one.
Be real black for me.
Am I supposed to know that song?
That's Roberta. No. Nobody's supposed to know. No, it's Roberta Flack and Donnie Hathaway. Donnie Flack away, Roberta Hathaflack. But no, yeah, you wanted to start on that one?
No.
Honestly, I don't.
Okay,
good. All right, well, then me. No,
well, Edgar, I mean, you mentioned. Sorry.
I see. I tried to pass it. I think this guy. Where's the person who's been nodding their head the whole time? This guy right here with the glasses on. He wants to take it.
You know, but you did mention how the work itself creates a world of its own, and that it merely references the kind of immediate spaces that we ourselves or we as artists occupy. And so, I wonder to what extent is the space itself the artist, or are we the artist? And can you just talk a little bit more about your interpretation of that?
Well, I did a presentation in San Francisco. Do you guys know the filmmaker Greg Tate? Anybody know this person? Cultural critic, theorist. So I was real nervous, you know, because I knew he was going to be there in this little room. I was giving this presentation at CCA. And then at the end, he was like, Edgar, everything that you did was black. It was all black. You know, that's what black people do. That's the methodologies that we use in our cult, blah, 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 blah. And I'm sitting there, I'm looking at him, I'm like, I can't deny that that's a part of who I, of what makes up me.
Sure.
I have no reason or intention to deny it. I just can't argue it outside of sort of anecdote.
Right.
It's not really useful for me to argue that the methodologies or the strategies that I use in my work are by some larger extent, the expression of my Negrotude within the U.S., or me as sort of being a socially, a culturally informed being. Because everything that I try to do is all about shunning predeterminacy. Mm-hmm. So I have a certain kind of pleasure with mm-hmm. with the notion that even though I think that I'm doing something which is unique and innovative, oh, but by the way, that's really just what black people do anyway. You know what I mean? Is that really what I want to wake up in the morning at the end of my life and go, God damn it, I was fooling myself this whole time. You know what I'm saying? Like, I should have just went on and just played the blues. You know, I could have just forgotten. But I didn't have to deal with it. Like,
aren't you glad that he answered the question?
I think that's really interesting because the predeterminacy that you're also, dodging at some level. Like at some level, you're refusing the predeterminism.
Well, I mean, I'm looking at it. I mean, I'm.
You don't want to be apprehended by predeterminism.
No, which is the reason why I try to engage it directly.
Right. But I think that there's something to be said. I think there's something to be said that when people are forced to contend with something that violates their impression of what black cultural production is supposed to do, as you, the joke is like, is it just supposed to sing the blues? No, it's also supposed to put Tuvok, Tupac, and Spock together. I find that really interesting, and it also challenges the predeterminacy. So so for me, not saying that's what you should do, but I'm saying that for me, I'm really interested in, two anecdotes. The first, I was showing my first manuscript to a bunch of different presses, and there was a poem in there called "Shadow Boxer on the Lookout," and it was about, you know, how being a black person, sometimes you walk down the street and you might see another black person and you might cross the street, right? You might be afraid of your own people. And my name is Douglas Kearney. My name is going to be Sean Douglas Kearney, just as Irish as you can get. And people who were reading my manuscript, I heard back, would say things like, oh my God, I hope this isn't a white person writing this poem. Okay, so you have that. Mm. And then I was talking to some kind of established experimental writers, and they were talking about, you know, your poetry is different because it's experimental, and there really aren't like black people doing experimental poetry like that. So both of these things are kind of notions, right, that my work, being from who I am, forces a kind of porousness into those categories. Like if you're dealing with bipartisanship, like we're dealing with, you're dealing with these kinds of extremes, part of the sort of slapstick comedy of the last last 3 years in particular has been a complete allergy to porousness on the part of certain politicians. So that if an idea comes from over here, there has to be a kind of a refusal of it. There's a new comedy called Key and Peele. I don't know if people have watched it.
Yeah,
there's this great sketch that totally dramatized that, where Obama's sitting there and he's with a bunch of Republicans and he says, like, well, you know, I think we need to have gun control. They're like, no gun control. He kind of goes, well, then we should have no gun control. And they kind of go, no, we need gun control. We need gun control, because it's coming from this thing and there can't be any porousness. So I do feel like sometimes there's something useful in that presence and a certain level of interesting intent. And one other thing that I wanted to say is, because I talked about the idea of hiding things in plain sight, but I also think that there is something about a long standing, and we talked about this the other night, a long-standing kind of cultural project in African-American aesthetic traditions, which is about kind of holding contradiction and kind of going, see, it doesn't evaporate, it creates something new. Probably the most popular example we could think of is like soul music, the blend of secular message with song techniques that are oftentimes associated with a sacred space. That is a contradiction. You're not supposed to sing about staying up at a club all night with Jesus in your voice. You're not supposed to do that. When you do it,
Al Green.
Right, that Al Green, exactly. Al Green's a perfect example. He becomes a pastor, but then he comes back later on, lay it down, you know? You know, like, I mean, so that is a contradiction. And so much of the work of African American aesthetics has been about presenting and managing contradiction. And it's difficult for me to disentangle that from a particular subjectivity of a people who were not considered a people. Who am I if I'm not a person legally, but I am a person? So that is a contradiction at an existential level. So I feel like some of the aesthetic
process of that tradition. And it's not that black people are the only people who work with contradiction, but soul music, everybody's heard of it. So it's obviously something that is interesting in a type of production. So I do see something interesting in a tradition that doesn't necessarily by definition have to be limiting, and is in practice not necessarily any more limiting than anything we could learn in any school or avant-garde.
We're supposed to have people ask questions now?
We will. Okay. So where do you feel... Yeah, just one more, actually. Where do you feel financial architecture plays a role in this larger project? In this larger cultural project, as Doug was saying.
Right. The term financial architecture actually came from a friend of mine by the name of Miguel Garcia, who used to be the executive director of LISC here in downtown. And he said to me one day, he's like, Edgar, you know, I think the work that you guys are doing down in Watts is great, but you really need a person like me to who builds new financial architecture to be able to match kind of the irregularity of what you're doing. And I was completely blown away by this. I was like, people with finance think about sculpture and architecture? Like, that was like really, you know, kind of fantastic for me. But with the experiences that I had with Watts House Project, which it's about 15 years old now, when it first started off as just an art project. And when I took over it in 1999, there was a very one-to-one ratio between the work and the families. If we raised the money, I would work with the family, we'd do some work, and that was it. They would help, I would help. If we needed anybody else to help, they would help. But it was a pretty kind of flattened out thing. But when we decided to incorporate, and when the IRS got involved, immediately hierarchies formed. Because you have to have a board of directors, you have to have a president, you have to have a treasurer, you have to have a secretary. Executive director, and then where does the community fit into that? But one of the things that I also understood was that through the forming of the organization, it had a direct impact upon our mission, our intent, and our values that had actually engendered us to get to that process in the first place. And, you know, some of through the process of being an artist here in LA, I've got to become friends with Michael Govan and Annie Philbin. And most people don't know that Michael Govan actually started off as an artist, and he studied underneath, it's right on the tip of my tongue. He's in San Diego, he just passed away recently. They did a big retrospective of Alan Capra.
Capra.
He studied with Capra. But, you know, Capra kind of convinced them that you can work inside the institution and also be an artist too. And he said, guess what, Edgar, is not true. You can't. Because I don't make any art anymore. And he told me, don't stop making art. You know, and Annie Philbin was an artist as well. So oftentimes when we're pursuing the things that we're looking for, the passion, which is really the fuel, gets compromised. And we're able to use a kind of rationale which says, well, we need the money, so we have to keep doing it. But then the very reason why you started ultimately starts to fade and to change. So what I was advocating for by producing that slide was an argument for seeing a kind of a deep and fundamental connection between what on the outside looks like very different kind of practices, like how can you both be working in the community at the studio at the same time, which produce a kind of a false dialectic, I think, where in reality... The reason why they're not so different is because at the heart of it, it's about having a practice that's grounded in building meaningful relationships. And the discourse that informs the work that we make in the studio is in itself personal. It is alive because you're making work, you're talking to your peers, they're talking to you, it informs their practice, that informs yours.
Right.
That is community, I guess you could say.
So let's take it to the community. Questions from the audience. The mics are coming around to you. Go ahead.
First, I want to commend you. I found your ability to speak about art and your artwork very thought-provoking.
Thank you.
And I admire the fact, from the little we've been exposed to your work, that what is common to both of you is your ability to push into new areas when you spoke about the spaces that people aren't doing. But it seems to me in art, all sorts of arts, the corporate idea of branding is getting into it. And artists feel that compulsion sometimes. And I was wondering if you could speak towards how if you feel that's going on, and if you fought it, or how you fight that off in your own artwork.
I mean, I suppose that you're sort of speaking about it kind of in the most extreme sense, where the brand is the star, and there's really no content behind it. I think, you know, within the age of social networks and media, I mean, currency is driven by hits. You know, it's how many people are actually looking at you. The difference with it existing within the discourse of contemporary practice is that those hits should be, in their essence, meaningful in some way. That it should be driving of kind of a larger kind of building upon the practice, as opposed to simply flattening it out or reducing it to simple metaphors or cliches. The branding element, I guess you could call it that, or you know, you can say that you are building relationships in a kind of an expansive way. I think that it really depends upon how meaningful those interactions are, and how you yourself as the practitioner sort of imagine that, right? I mean, we have to think through these things because we are all parts of the circuitry of technology, which we have no control over. I mean, there's a guy walking around here shooting pictures right now. I mean, he could have caught one of you digging in your ear. You weren't doing that. I was watching you the whole time. But, you know, a little Photoshop, and there you go.
There it is.
That's it, you know. The guy digging in his ear with the red glasses.
Let's take a few more.
That's the meme right there.
I really appreciate the conversation towards the end where you were really talking about the tools that you're using. And one of the points that I wanted you guys to address a little bit more, I find that this question of playing with absence and memory is actually, I think, a connection between both your works. And I like how both of you are using that practice or that framework, which I find to be very quintessential in the U.S., because we're always working with fragments anyway, especially if you know, it was forced migration or your history is slowly being erased. So I find it very, very American. I'm getting there. I find it very American to speak with fragment and how you're playing with memory. So one of the things I wanted to ask you is to really elaborate a little bit more on the use of juxtaposition and absence in your work. And then a direct question to Douglas, if the poem Is Ain't, was it in any way a reference to Glenn Leon's work? And the series of paintings that he does using the work of Ellison. Oh, not Ellison. Yes, Ralph Ellison? No. Now yeah. I'm like yeah. forgetting yeah. that. So yeah. those two.
So let's start with absence and memory.
Yeah.
Those are great questions, by the
yeah,
way.
Yeah, and they actually have a character count when people are talking, so you really only get to ask one question, but we'll let it slide because Raina is a friend of ours, so we're going to go I'll take the juxtaposition part, if that's
sure,
okay.
Sure, that's fine.
So the strategy of dislocation is completely linked to juxtaposition. So in the early films of, just to problematize things, who shot A Birth of a Nation?
Oh, D.W. Griffith.
D.W. Griffith in his very early films.
The greatest filmmaker in all of American
history. Well, actually, he has some there are a lot of accomplishments that
yeah,
he had before that yeah. part of his life. But, you know, one of the things in his early films he used to do, because it was really an extension of the theater, was that he would allow the camera to actually move back and forth from room to room. So you would see the division, and then at times the camera would go back, and then he would let you see the activity going on in both rooms simultaneously. What that was meant to do in reality was to show you two things, but then in reality to be talking about something which is not in the frame, which is the direct relationship between them, or you could call it its synthesis, right? So juxtaposition, and particularly within my work, because I use it in its relationship to determinacy and chance, is always a way of dislocating the subject. So it's like, I'm showing you Spock, I'm showing you Tupac, I'm showing you Tuvok, but what I'm actually talking about is not in the frame at all. It's over here. And by over here, I mean that it's in here, right? You see it, but it's not being drawn out. And I think that that was beautiful about the way in which you were talking about your work, because I think that that's a strategy which you use too.
Yeah. I mean, the fragment starts off for me as the ability to have multiple voices in a single piece. And that's a technique. And what you're saying about the limits of technology limiting, at defining the art form. Like when you think of early sample-based hip-hop music, a lot of the samples were stuck with a very short amount of time because the sample memory bank was like 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. So as the sampling technology begins to get longer, you can do more complex sampling. But the technique of scratching in another voice, the technique of having, an old cowboy on a dance on a hip hop song like De La Soul's Three Is a Magic Number, mm-hmm. you know, like having that mix in creates this multiple texture that insists that there is a synthesis of those things because they're both in here. It's contained, so they both can be in this space, which is an interesting sort of parallel.
But I wanted to add another element, which is that if the relationships are based on chance, or if they're based on metonymy, which is relationships which are derived through culture as opposed through convention, conventional understandings, then it allows for you to understand that within those juxtapositions within their current context now, but you also understand that those things are not fixed, right. That it will move. Right. And that is an expression, again, of sort of the life of meaning, as opposed to it being kind of locked down into one set of codes. And I think that hip-hop is all about that, right. You know?
Right. That's... And just, yes, the answer to the other part of the question is, I'd actually just been really engaging his work through Darby English.
Just say yes.
So we have time for two more questions. How about that term? Or over there.
Hi, I really enjoyed both of your presentations, but I was really fascinated by the Watts House Project. Mm-hmm. I work in Watts, and in an after-school program for elementary school kids, all of which live in Nickerson Gardens housing projects.
Which school?
And so my question...
Which school?
Oh, 112 Street. My question is how... They recently painted the Nickerson Gardens housing projects from whitewash to yellow. Which I find an interesting way to sort of try to find the beauty in some of the struggles of the community. So I guess my question is sort of how can we sort of incorporate beauty and art into the housing projects, which are a site of a lot of pain, but also a lot of vibrancy and community.
Right. Creativity and the arts are a really good vehicle for bringing people together because it allows you to move beyond the isms and the kind of predeterminacies that you come to a space with, because it becomes centered around the work. So when you become focused on a task, you can kind of forget about yourself. Like for any of the creative people in here who've been in that space of working where all of a sudden everything just kind of makes sense somehow. Mm. Like there's a kind of a rhythm, a connection between your body and the world.
Yeah.
Like art is really good for that. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be great. It doesn't mean it's going to look good, but I think that in the space of what you're talking about, like a housing project where there may be a lot of distrustfulness amongst the people who live there or divisions, if you can allow for the artwork to be a monument to the forming of meaningful and trusting relationships, then that work takes on a whole other level of vibrancy that it wouldn't have otherwise. If you see it as an ongoing activity as opposed to one thing, we're done with that. But you see it as like, what are we going to do next? This felt really great. What are we going to do again? So you have to frame the question properly, and then you get interesting answers.
Hmm. One last question.
Okay, thanks to have a black voice in here. I'm a non-academic poet, artist, and activist, and I'm from the South. So
where are you from?
Nashville, Tennessee.
All right, cool.
But being from the Bible Belt and going to various churches and such like that, I've been to a lot of black churches and I've been to a lot of white churches in the South, and I noticed that in black churches, the they do a lot of preaching, and in the white churches, they do a lot of teaching.
Okay.
And I find similarities in poets, between black poets and white poets. I find that black poets tend to be emotional and expressive, and a lot of white poets tend to be solemn and descriptive. And I was wondering, because you were speaking about juxtaposition earlier, and I was wondering, Mr. Kearney,
yes,
you're very much a very expressive poet, and I'm very influenced by poets such as Donnell Lee, whom I find you seem to be reminiscent of him. And I was wondering if, number one, if he is influence on you, he's a great influence upon me, as well as so many others, and if you have noticed this juxtaposition between how poets of various cultures express themselves in their writing and such like that.
Okay. No, that's an excellent question. I mean, the first half of the question, in reading the book, The Black Poets, you know, which is like that kind of biblical anthology, and reading his work in there was very important to me at a foundational level. What's fascinating to me about the techniques of the black church as it informs a kind of oral performance is the opportunity to see how it has transformed into everything from spoken word poetry to different kind of approaches to rap, where you can get like a very cerebral, introspective type of rap from somebody like the Wu-Tang to something that's a bit more the kind of exhortation, the kind of the preaching voice that happens with somebody like Chuck D, even though there is this kind of deep bed of knowledge that you have to have going in there. I think that I've seen that kind of contrast. I don't know if I always see it strictly among racial lines. I do see it among sort of lines of where people are in terms of institutions. Like if you go to get your MFA, I was a part of a fellowship called Cave Canem, which is black poets. And when I first got into it, there was actually a kind of a sense that they didn't have a lot of spoken word poets involved in Cave Canem. And that there was a kind of, interestingly enough, a silly way to put it, but is a kind of an affirmative action, make sure they started having more than one like spoken word poet in Cave Canem. So even that institution, which was founded for black poets, from the simple idea of being able to sit in a workshop and not have to explain what a hot comb is, you know, so you just put it in your poem and then somebody would understand it. That became a kind of a factor of that organization. I would say that the teaching that oftentimes happens within the kind of black church tradition is probably, my experience with it has been that it bleeds over into daily life enough that when you come to the pastor, there's an expectation that you already have a certain knowledge base, a certain set of cultural references, a certain set of religious references. But that tone of that emotion is definitely something that engages me and that I'm interested in communicating through my work. But I love the idea of doing that using some techniques that are associated with a more cerebral approach, because then there's that muddying of that division. And at my readings, there tends to be kind of two layers of presentation. There is what we call the banter, which is me talking, okay, well, this poem is doing this, that, and the blah, blah, blah. And then I'll do the poem. And that's where I'm able to kind of consolidate those things as a single sort of performance, single kind of continuity. But yeah, that idea of the preaching versus the teaching, you do see that evidenced in different poetry communities, sometimes not along racial lines, because if you look at the spoken word community, generally speaking, it's using the same set of tropes across racial lines because of the sense of immediacy and urgency that spoken word is supposed to engender. So, yeah.
Thank you for expanding that. That was great. Let's have a round of applause for our poets.
A Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.